We're up to Be'er Arvi, section Ches, according to the Hardman edition. And he's continuing on the weepy theme. Right? Remember last week we learned about the Gemara where it spoke about where the Maral explained the Gemara that spoke about how the earthquakes are a reflection of divine tears that fall into the ocean and shake things up. And we explained, and we learned from the Maral the explanation of what that itself would actually mean. Now we're holding in the Maral's on the theme, going to continue on another Gemara about the weepy. And that is Gemara in Chagiga Daf Hei Amud Beis. Very, very, very fascinating Gemara. We will try to share a couple of approaches to this within one approach from the Maral. Then I'm going to share with you also an approach of Rav Hudner on this Gemara, which I shared briefly earlier. The Gemara is on Chagiga Daf Hei Amud Beis, and the Gemara says like this. The Pasuk says in Yirmiyahu, V'im lois yishma'ua, and if you don't listen to this, V'amistorim tifka nafshi mipnei geva, my heart will weep, v'mistorim, in a hidden place, mipnei geva, because of the lost greatness. Says the Gemara, Amar Rav Shmuel bar Unya mishmei de Rav. Rav Shmuel bar Unya said in the name of Rav, Mokam yesh loy lakodesh baruch hu umistorim shemoy. Hashem has a place which he knows, which is known as Mistorim, which is known as a hidden place, Mistorim. And that's the place where Hashem will cry. Hashem will, simply, of course, you say, Hashem will cry in private. But the Gemara says that there's a specific place, so to speak, that Hashem has, which is called Mistorim, the hidden place where Hashem cries. It says, more, my Mipnei Geva. What does it mean, Mipnei Geva? Because of the greatness, Amar Rav Shmuel bar Yitzchok mibnei gavosan shol Yisrael, shenitla mehem v'nitna l'avdei kechavim. Geva is the greatness of the Jewish people, which was taken from them and given to the nations of the world. That's what Hashem is crying over. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmeni Amar, neisa gavosa shol malchus shamayim. He's not crying about the greatness of the Jewish people, he's crying about the greatness of the divine kingdom. In other words, that is no longer experiencing greatness on this earth by virtue of our recognition. Ask the Gemara, Umiika Bichia Kame HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'amar HaPapa Ein HaTzevus Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shenemar Hoid V'Hodar Lefana V'Aiz V'Chedva V'Imkaimai. Is there sadness with regard to Hashem? Can we speak about Hashem crying? But doesn't Rav Papa say that there is no sadness before Hashem, as it says, there is glory and greatness before Him, Oiz v'chedva, strength and happiness in His place? Says more like kasha. It's not difficult to resolve. Ha bebatei gavoi, ha bebatei baroi. It depends whether you're speaking about batei gavoi, the outer, the inner rooms, or the batei baroi, or the outer rooms. Bebatei baroi, in the outer rooms, there are no tears. There's always the good face that is put on. But it's bebatei gavoi, in the inner rooms, where you could find the tears. Where you would find the tears. Says the Gemara, bebatei baroi, in the outer rooms, there aren't tears. V'aksiv v'yikra Hashem elikim sukeis b'yem hu labachiyu l'misbeir v'korcha v'lachagor sak. Hashem will call on that day of the destruction for crying and so on and for the wearing of sackcloth. Which, by virtue of the fact that it says Vayikra, he will call, it sounds like this is not whimpering quietly in the corner. It sounds like it's an open declaration. Answers the Gemara, Shani Churban Beis Hamikdash, Dafilu Malachi Shalom Bachu. That was with the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. And there, even the angels of peace, everybody cried, Shenemar Heiner Elim Tzaku Chutzo Malachi Shalom Mar Yifkon. The angels of peace will cry bitterly. Okay, that's the Gemara. So the Gemara here, you know, when it speaks about Hashem crying, this is not a question on the words of Chazal, on the words of the sages. In fact, the verse refers to Hashem crying. Right? So whereas this book is a book in defense and in explanation and in the process, as we said, in the advancement of Divrei Chazal and the Omek and the depths of the understanding of the words of Chazal, but in fact the issue of the tears, of the divine tears, is the Gemara discussing only what already appears and what already is found quite explicitly in the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu. The Gemara is only coming to explain the verse. And it's the Gemara's explanation, as well as the original verse, that we have to understand. Of course, the first problem which he deals with is, what do we talk about over here? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Hashem is crying. Hashem is crying sounds like Hashem is suffering, Hashem disappointed, and so on and so forth. So the first thing which the Maral has to establish in this Gemara, and what we've spoken about, I think we talked about it at the very end last time, just very, very briefly, but we'll just spend a few minutes on it now. It's not a tremendous chiddush, but it has to be said. We have a perception of Hashem, which is a true perception of Hashem, that Hashem's existence per se is perfect, pure, and is not really dependent on anything. Hashem's existence is independent of anything else. When the Rambam speaks about the foundational principles of belief in Hashem, so one of them is that everything in the world is dependent for its existence on Hashem. But Hashem's existence is independent of anything else that exists in the world. That's how we can speak about Hashem as being kadmon. Hashem precedes the existence of the world. He didn't need the world's existence for his existence to be. His perfection is there before, after, during. It doesn't make any difference. Haya, hove, v'yeh, he was, he is, he will be, which of course jumbled together is the Shem Havaya, the name of God that we don't pronounce, is Haya, hove, v'yeh, right? Say that 10 times fast and you're going to say something that you're not supposed to say, right? So that is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu's existence is, again, before, after, during, and as his existence is independent. Absolutely independent of anything else. Hashem Elokim Emes. Right? That's the way the Rambam says it. Hashem Elokim is Emes. He's the only full truth. He's the only constant. He's only like Emes, which is Aleph, Mem, Tov, beginning, middle, end, Haya, Haya, Vavia, all together. That is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, however, it sounds like Hashem is having the equivalent of a divine bad hair day, right? He's breaking down and he's crying. What's going on over here? How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? How do we speak about this? It sounds like the Ribbono Shel Olam isn't so perfect, isn't so independent, isn't doing so well. So we understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we speak about, so to speak, his place. And then we speak about HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our place. HaKadosh Baruch Hu God chose at a certain point in time that he was going to create the world. He created the world in order, in a certain sense, to expand. To expand because of a divine desire, which we do not hesitate to attribute to Hashem, a divine desire to see godliness grow beyond where it didn't exist before. Now that's a little bit of a philosophical gymnastic. Why? Because if nothing else existed, so then how can you speak about godliness existing where it didn't exist before if nothing else existed other than Hashem? But the idea being, and again, and this, yes, this part is a little bit hard for us, at least those of us who are not God, to get our arms around and to understand and comprehend fully, is that the idea, right, the essential desire to share of one's goodness, right, is part of the chayk, so to speak, part of the quote-unquote, carefully used, part of the nature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so Hashem wanted, indeed, that there should be something that wasn't inherently him. He made room for it, right, what the mystics call tzimtzum, where Hashem narrows himself to allow something other than him to exist, and then, boom, blast it with the presence of Hashem, with the opportunity of the presence of Hashem, and to the extent that it accepts it, that it welcomes it, there Hashem has grown beyond to indeed extend and bring godliness to something else. That is the notion that we have of HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating. That's the notion which we have, of course, of when we speak about human beings as the climax of creation being created B'Tselem Elokim, in the divine image. What does that mean? Because we are the ones who have that potential to accept the presence of Hashem within us, to be something of a copy, something of an image of Hashem within us, which would be, wow, godliness has spread. Godliness has spread to include something, somebody else, into the world. In that process, Hashem is not perfect. What does that mean? Again, Hashem, in his original source, is perfect. And whether we accept it or not, whether we do it or not, Hashem's perfection is not going to be damaged. However, the effectiveness of the transfer, of giving over godliness, by its very, very definition, by its nature, by the way Hashem set it up, depends on our... There's places at the table, please. Join us. Depends on our receptivity to it, on our openness to being able to accept it. And that Hashem, by definition, leaves up to us, right? So that, in a sense, right, to experience godliness, we'll be the masters of that destiny, of whether that happens or not. And so, Hashem doesn't necessarily push revelation on us, push Mashiach on us. He waits to a certain degree for us to bring it in, for us to choose to have it. And as long as we haven't chosen to have it, so we have a world without the presence of Hashem, which is, of course, quote-unquote, a frustration for what Hashem wanted for us. It's a frustration for what Hashem wanted this world to be able to be. Now, He chose, again. It's not like, you know, when we're frustrated that, oh my gosh, we can't do this. This would be the equivalent of a frustration where you're able to do it 100%, right? You have an employee, right? And you give them a task, you give them a job, and you want them to do it. Now, they're not doing it so well. But the truth is, you can, if you really, really needed to, at any moment, you could step in and do it yourself. It's not like, in a certain sense, your business is on the line. You can do it yourself. But what you want is, you want that they should be able to do it. So you're watching them, and it's a frustration, but it's not a frustration. It's a frustration in the sense that, gosh, I want them to learn how to do it. On the other hand, it's not a frustration personally. It's not that, in a certain sense, you're going to be compromised by it. Now, over there, of course, you'll say, what are you talking about? You're going to be compromised by it because your employee can't do it, then you're stuck and you won't be able to go and open this other business or do this other thing or whatever else it is. So, you know, the limits of a metaphor we always experience when we're trying to make a mashal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the idea is, again, it's not an inherent Hashem problem. Hashem wanted us to have something for us. He wanted us to have something. And He's disappointed when we don't. And the cries of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are that the godliness is not therefore going to be included in the world. Now, from our perspective, we also say that no, but it's a terrible thing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't here. And look, how could it be? It would be, in a certain sense, a frustration for Hashem that, hey, look, He created this world and we're ignoring Him. How could it be that, you know, that would be a terrible thing? To some degree, you know, while Hashem is frustrated because He wants us to have the good, but He's more frustrated for us than He is frustrated for Himself. Okay. A little bit, again, when we're dealing with these things, there's going to be a little bit of gymnastics. So the thing is, again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu crying is not that, oh my gosh, I can't believe it, I'm stuck, you know, I'm bankrupt, I'm this, that, or the other thing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, these tears are relative to the world, are relative to the world's acceptance of Hashem, relative to the world's success in the project of expanding the godliness of Hashem to include it. So what is with these tears? And what is the nature of these tears that the Gemara, the verse says that I cry in private, b'mistorim. The Gemara says Hashem has a place which is called mistorim, called the private place. And the Gemara asks, does Hashem cry in private, does Hashem cry in public? And the Gemara says, oh no, he cries only in private, again, only in private, not in public, except for the time of the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, when it's all out on the table. What is this referring to? What does this mean? So the Maharal offers, interestingly, two interpretations of what it means crying in hiding. What does it mean by these inner places as opposed to the outer places? and in a certain sense, they're complementary interpretations. The first interpretation is what I think we probably would have said instinctively, which is, when we think inner or outer, right, we could think already about this week's parsha. Yaakov Avinu and Esav HaRasha, Yaakov and Esav are born to Yitzchak and Rivka, and you know, Esav is an Isho De'atzayit Isoda, he's a man who knows hunting, he's a man of the fields, he's out there. And Yaakov is an Ishtam, a simple person, pure person, Yoshev HaHolim, who dwells inside in the tents. We go on and we speak about the voice of Yaakov versus the hands of Esav, which is understood not just that, you know, okay, you sound like Yaakov, but you have hairy arms like Esav, which is, of course, the simple meaning of the text, you know, when Yaakov is feeling his way, Yitzchak is feeling his way around the person who's sitting in front of him and is sending these mixed signals about who he is. But we understand, as Chazal understood, that HaKol Kol Yaakov Ayidayim Yidei Esav was, Yaakov has a definitive characteristic, and that is that his work is done in the realm of the voice, which is something which comes from the inside, whereas the work of Esav is done from the hands, which is, the hands are superficial. In a certain sense, they are the most superficial part of the person, the most external part of the person. Esav works on the outside, and Yaakov works on the inside. Esav is the man of the fields on the outside, Yaakov is the man of the tents on the inside. And we understand as well what Chazal told us as the beautiful metaphor. You know, Esav is compared to what? To which animal? Anybody know? To the chazir. To the pig. Why? Okay, so you could think of many, many different possibilities as to why Esav is compared to the chazir. The Chazal focus on one thing, and they say that Esav, that, you know, the chazir, ironically, right, when you think about treifus, when you think about something that's non-kosher, what's the classic example of something which isn't kosher? Say it's a pig, right? And in Yiddish, there's an expression, treif v'chazer. Right, treif v'chazer, it's non-kosher like pig, right? It's the worst thing. But you know, pig is not one of the most non-kosher minim that you would think. Why? Because what does it take to be kosher? You need to have two signs, right? It has to have split hooves, and it has to chew its cud, right? So you can argue that a chazir is 50% kosher. Why? Because a chazir does have split hooves. It just doesn't chew its cud. It's one of those few animals that the Torah lists, which has this siman as opposed to that siman, this sign of kashrus as opposed to that one, but sorry, right? Close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, right? So it's not going to do it. If it only has one siman, it doesn't do it. The chazir. That's the thing. The chazir, say Chazal, however, does use this 50% to its advantage. It tries to be maret lofer. It tries to stick out its hoofs, whether front, back, right? It sticks out its hoofs and it says, look, see, I'm fine. I have split hoofs. Say Chazal, that was Esav. Right? What did Esav do? He used to go to his father and he used to ask him very pious questions. He would say, Father, tell me something. How exactly do you separate miser on salt? You don't have to separate miser on salt. Salt doesn't grow from the ground. Salt is a mineral. Right? So you don't have to separate miser on salt. But he's asking these really, really firm questions. He's presenting himself as a hunter who does and deceives and presents something. Right? Oh, here you go. Here's a nice piece of meat or something like that. You know, but really, inside, it's going to grab it up. It's going to snare it. Right? That's the nature of the tzad. The tzad shows one thing and means another. And that's Esav. You know that we understand that indeed these two signs of kashrus, right? The Gra writes about this very, very magnificently, that the two signs of kashrus represent these two things. Because on the one hand you have the split hooves, which is the outside. And you have the chewing of the cud, which is very, very much an inner part of the system. So we say that, you know, a person or anything in the world, in order for it to be kosher, It has to be kosher b'socho and b'barim. It has to be kosher on the inside, it has to be kosher on the outside. It's not just that your actions have to be good, but the inside can be corrupt. Forget if it's even just a deceitful thing. Right? In the case of Esav, he was trying to trick and say, look, this is what I do, but he didn't really even do it. Right? It was just showing one side of action as opposed to the other. But we understand it even more. And we say that the idea is, even if the actions on the outside are good, but you haven't finished the job. You haven't finished the job until you've also recultured your inside, that your inside is good. And if your inside is good, but your actions aren't good, also not great. Right? Remember how the book of the Kuzari, of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, primary book of Jewish philosophy, started with this searching non-Jewish king who used to have this repeated dream. And the dream was, Kavonoscha Ritzuya, Avol Maasecha Einam Ritzuya. Your intentions are good, but you're not doing the right things. Your intentions are good. And the dream came to him and came to him and came to him until he searched and he found. And a big part of the philosophy that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi articulates is the importance and the science of the actions prescribed by the Torah. It's not enough to have a good heart, but it's not enough to do good things and not have a good heart. So on the one hand, Esav represents the extreme of being good only on the outside, or trying to project the goodness on the outside like the Chazer, when the inside is corrupt. And I think it's worthy of thought and to consider, you know, we won't expand on that part of it right now, but why it is therefore that we say treif v'chazer, right? That the chazer is considered the paradigm, not the one that's bad on the outside and on the inside, but the one that's, you know, has this ability to demonstrate on the outside, but even while the inside remains corrupt. But Chazal speak about this, and just I'll tell you what the Goyen says, just beautiful, beautiful. They say this on the famous Gemara, which we all have to, which we all know and we all have to keep in mind, where the Gemara says, you know, the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, 70 years, it was up again. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, no end in sight. We don't know. It's been already a couple of thousand years, and who knows what's going on. Says the Gemara, what was the first Beis HaMikdash destroyed for? For Gilui Arayos, Shfichus Damim, and Avodah Zarah, for the three cardinal sins, immorality, murder, idolatry. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed for what? Sinas Chinam, needless hatred. The Gemara says, what was going on? I mean, they were involved in Torah and Gemilus Chassad, and they were doing all kinds of nice things. But Sinas Chinam, they had this hatred that they harbored towards each other. Says the Gemara, Toiva Kreisan Shel Rishonim Mitziparnam Shel Acharonim. Right? Says the Gemara, says the Gemara, the stomachs of the first ones were better than the fingernails of the outer ones. What's the idea? So the idea is that the first ones, the outer actions were bad, but the inner actions were okay. Right? So therefore, since all they did, they had some bad things on the outside, like Nizgal Avoinam, they all had to fix what was going on the outside, and they would be okay. But the second ones, right? So we had good fingernails, right? Everything looked good. We had all this Torah going on, all these kindness organizations going on, but we had this, heaven forbid, but we had it, and I guess we still have it to some degree if the Beis HaMikdash hasn't been rebuilt, right? We had this inner rot. Right? And that was a bigger, bigger challenge. And the Goyen says, that's the Gemara. The stomach is one simen, the chewing of the cud, the digestive system. And the other one, the fingernails, is of course the hoofs. And he says that those are the two signs of kashrus, and the easier one, it's easier to get your toenails clipped, right, than it is to get lo'aleinu abdominal surgery, right, to change the kishkis. Is a lot more. To change what's going on inside is much more essential and much more difficult than what's going on the outside. Yeah,
I'm a bit surprised that going back to Esav, I think my son saw looking from the father, but on the inside is rotten. First, I'm a bit surprised that that's the example, because it seems as though what we're talking about is that even when the outside is proper and
that's correct,
so would have thought. The idea of the kibbutz of would have been brought out. But does Chazal use this example to show that even his kibud av, even those things that he did do that were lemaisa, actual actions of kibud av, were nevertheless tainted with this notion of trying to appear from, like, right. why are you taking so Meisr and salt?
That's far from clear. In other words, Chazal do view Esav as having done great kibud av. And Chazal, for instance, also, very fascinatingly, in many, many later generations, when the Gemara is discussing kibud av ha'eim, and the Gemara says, tell me, ad heichan kibud av ha'eim, what's the ultimate, well, give me an example of how far one goes with kibud av ha'eim, says the Gemara, says, let's learn from a non-Jew in Ashkelon, over kochav me'echad ba'ashkelon, and his name was Dama ben Asina, very interesting, his name was Dama. Dama means dam, right, which is like Edom, right, blood, Edom, right, was also, Esau was also associated with this redness. And here, that's the famous story where the Chachamim needed to buy the Avonim, the Ephod, they needed to buy stones for the Ephod, and he was the one who had them for the vestments of the Kohen Gadol. There was a stone which was lost, and they had to go and buy it, and he had it, but the key to the storehouse was under his father's pillow, and he wouldn't wake up his father, and he lost the deal. Right, so we learn it from him. The Gemara is learning a certain genuineness to that. Yes, you're right, and I tried to allude to it a little bit before, but not explain it fully, which is that Esav is the extreme that we're portraying over here with this, you know, chazerfus, what's called in Yiddish, you know, the chazer foot, the pig's foot that is getting stuck out, where even that is deceitful. But on a certain level, the notion is the external, the superficial, and that's the pshat and the kibud av ha'eim of Esav. Why is the kibud av ha'eim of Esav so great, and a better example than the kibud av ha'eim of Yaakov Avinu? Very simple. We have three partners in every human being. Three superiors. Every one of us, forget who you work for, right? We were born with three superiors. And those are Father, Mother, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why, as Ramban explains, that's why the first tablets of the first of the two tablets of the Luchos, which contain, so to speak, mitzvahs between man and God, have as the fifth commandment honoring your parents. Why? Because really, it's, well, Ramban explains it with all kinds of words, but the way I would say it concisely is that the second tablet is mitzvahs between peers. The first tablet is mitzvahs towards your superiors. Right? And a parent is a superior. As the Gemara says, all of the mitzvahs that we have regarding the parents are echoes of mitzvahs that we have regarding Hashem, regarding God. Now, what happens if your father tells you to be Mechal Shabbos? So you're not allowed to listen to your father. Why? Because in the three partners that you have, there is a hierarchy. Your parents also have to honor God. And therefore, they're out of bounds if they tell you to ignore, right? It's a two-tiered hierarchy in a certain sense. So you know that every person who believes in God has this sort of damper, this sort of limit on their honor for their parents. Now you know, sometimes we experience that in very, very real ways when we might have this kind of a conflict. You know, your parents want you to come and they want you to eat over. But maybe they don't keep kosher, right? So what are you going to do now, right? So you're going to have all these issues, and as much as you want to honor your parents, but you have to honor the God that's everybody's God, and you're going to be busy negotiating this thing, and it's very, very complicated. And you know, they might say to you, and they might be right, that you know something, you might have been a better child before you found religion, right? Why? Because then you had only one superior, or only, well, each parent will say you had only one, but the truth is, right? you had only your parents. You didn't have to worry about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you understand that when you're looking at these parents, there's the outer creator and the inner creator. The outer creator is, creators are the father and mother. The inner creator is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Esav did not acknowledge fundamentally the inner creator, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the only ones, he did acknowledge his parents, he was very aware of the physical world. So he truly, truly recognized them, and he truly, truly therefore honored them. and he honored them in a certain sense more than Yaakov Avinu, who viewed his parents as being only one tier up, but there was something beyond them, something even beyond and greater than them, that he had to worry about, that made them fail. Not fail, but fade in comparison. That's an example. You know, the excellence of Esav within the certain ethic of Esav, but it's an ethic which recognizes the physical world and does not recognize the inner workings of the spiritual world. Right? The hands of Esav are real. They're successful. They're significant. However, the hands of Yaakov, in a certain sense, right? The voice of Yaakov goes beyond, in the sense that the voice of Yaakov is addressing the inner issues that are there within the world. We will, Be'ezrat Hashem, probably dedicate more thought to this, whether in one of the upcoming Parsha Shiurim, where we're going to be talking about the Avos and Tefillah. So this will be one of the issues which will be discussed, whether it will be this week or next week, coming to a website near you. But there's that inner hour. And so says the Maharal, the first instinctive understanding, which is that when we speak about the inner world versus the outer world, right, we're talking about the spiritual world versus the physical aspects of the world. When we speak about HaKadosh Baruch Hu crying b'mistorim, crying in this hidden place, so the idea... but not so ay-ay-ay, not so okay on the inner level of the world. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu's crying over is not that, you know, there aren't advancements in science, that there aren't beautiful buildings and communities and cities being built. What he's crying over is the spiritual failing, the absence of a heart, of an inner world that is there. And that's b'mistorim tivka nafshi. That's the cries of HaKadosh Baruch Hu inside. Right? Very, very understandable, I think, very sort of straightforward within that kind of an agadaic phrase. The Maharal offers a second understanding, which is as follows. When he speaks about the outer versus the inner, it's not sort of like the hidden, the subtle versus the outer, which is sort of the external. But he speaks about it, and it's a remarkable thing. Again, it's complementary to a certain degree, but he speaks about it as the basic structural versus the sort of the extras. What does that mean? He says, you know, if you look at a building, right? So, you know, if the outside isn't in shape, it doesn't mean like the outside meaning, you know, that there's a nice marble front. But it means the shell of the building. Right? When you build a house, what do? First thing you do is you put up the shell, right? You make the foundation and you make the outer walls and you get it under the roof, right? And then, eventually, right, the next steps are going to be to start working on the inside. And the more inside you get, the more non-essential it is, right? It's going to be impossible to live in a house without outer walls and a roof. Once you have outer walls and a roof, you know, so maybe, you know, you can go lay down some sleeping bags inside and you'll be able to manage. But it's still going to be pretty schwach. Pretty weak. You're going to get to start getting the inner walls up and divide the rooms, so then it's going to be better, right? But then, you know, you still don't have the drywall up, but, you know, people have lived in rooms without the drywall being up. Then you put the drywall up. Now, you know, you can even start getting, you know, your 14-year-old to actually move into the room, right? But, you know, you still don't have it painted. Right? The more you get inner and inner and inner, the more you're getting to the less and less essential, but at the same time you're getting to the more and more refined and geschmack and pleasurable and nice. So, again, this is not a contradiction to the first interpretation. But what the Maharal is pointing out is that if Hashem was crying, in a certain sense, all the way in the outside, then that would be a sign that the whole world had gone down. Right? In the Mabul, we can speak about, so to speak, Hashem crying on the outside. Because the outer walls came down, the roof came down, the whole thing went under. However, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was crying about at this stage is not where the whole thing went under, but that enhancement of the world, which is, would come with the Beis HaMikdash, which should come with all of these things, that is what is missing. That's what he refers to as the inner, as opposed to the outer. The inner is sort of the extra, the luxury. Now, it's a little bit of a surprising mara. Why? Because for us, viewing the inner world as essential, we say, if the inner world isn't there, then the whole thing has gone under. And in a certain sense, that's exactly the way we're supposed to do things. Can I borrow your chumash? Or whoever's chumash? Or the shul's chumash? Okay, so here we are. Vayomer Hashem. Vayar Hashem. Ki rabba ra'as Adam ba'aretz. Hashem saw that the evil of man had grown, you know, significantly in the world. And the thoughts of the direction of his heart were bad all the day. Hashem was regretful that he saw that he had made man on this earth. And he became sad. And Hashem said, I'm going to erase man from upon the face of the earth. Okay, man did bad. So therefore Hashem is going to destroy him from upon the face of the earth. In the next, that's the end of Parshas Bereishis, where we have the introduction to the Mabul and to Noah. But then, look at the beginning of Parshas Noach. Vatishoches ha'aretz lifneo Elokim. Okay, we're going to translate this in a literal way. Without using definition 1, definition 2, definition 3 in the dictionary, but the instinctive definition we'd use in this book. The earth was destroyed before God. When was this verse said? Before the Mabul. We translate, I imagine, let's take a look, we'll say corrupted, right? Right, the Vatishoches Ha'aretz Lifnei Elokim means the earth had become corrupt before God, because the term Shachas can mean corruption, as it can mean destruction. But the Torah chooses, obviously, the exact same word as it's going to use shortly to describe the physical destruction of the world. The world was destroyed, quote unquote, destroyed in an inner sense, that this world was destroyed and corrupt before God, and the world was filled with chametz. And Hashem saw that the world was destroyed, b'nei nishkasa, or again, corrupt, because all flesh had destroyed their way, had corrupted their ways. And Hashem says, and behold, I'm going to, it tells Noach, the end of all flesh is coming before me, because the earth is filled with chametz, which is extortion, whatever, stealing, v'hinani mashchisam es ha'aretz, and I'm going to destroy them with the earth. What do you mean you're going to destroy them? They're already destroyed. Oh, no, no. Before they were corrupted, now they're going to be destroyed. But corrupted means destroyed, and destroyed means corrupted. What is it saying? What is it saying? So, to borrow a phrase from the Gemara, what it's saying is, kimcha techina tachanta. Right? Which means, flour. I'm just following up on the same approach we used before. Which is, you've taken already ground flour, and you've put it into the mill. Big kunz. I'm going to demonstrate, right? You know, I'm going to demonstrate how well this food processor works. It cuts, dices, slices, and grinds, right? So here it goes. I'm going to take this bag of flour, I'm going to put it in, and look what comes out. A bag of flour. Right? Unbelievable. Right? That's what the Gemara said. Who did it say it to? Who did it say it to? It said it to Nebuchadnezzar. It said it to the destroyers of the Beis HaMikdash. They said, oh, big show off you are, right? You went and you destroyed God's house. You didn't destroy God's house. Before you laid a finger on it, it was already destroyed. What does that mean? Its whole life, its whole existence, its whole strength came from the presence of Hashem which was within it. Since the presence of Hashem was already squeezed out of it by us. So it was nothing. It was a shell. It was dust that was sort of just like held together. You blow on it and it's going to crumble. You ground up ground flour. When Hashem brought the Mabul, way the verse is presenting it, in a certain sense, it wasn't a tour de force. It was, the world crumbled under its own weight. Crumpled under its own weight. It had already destroyed itself. All that was left was for the physical building, quote unquote, to fall apart. On a certain level, that's the way we see things. For the Maharal to therefore present it and say, oh, you know, the outer structure, you know, the basic stuff was still in place. That's why Hashem doesn't cry on the outside. He's only crying over the inside, you know, like the extras, the nuances. It's a shocking thing for him to say that. So there are two ways to explain it. I'll explain it in the sort of like the basic practical way, but then I'll explain to you the way I really feel. The practical way to explain it is, well, yeah, you know that's true. On a certain level, it's only vulnerable. But the Mabul really was a tour de force. You know, I mean, still, it's true. All the spiritual reasons why it happened were that way. But the world was still functioning pretty well with all that corruption. And there did have to come that moment where it would be destroyed. And the Beis HaMikdash was still there, and people were still able to bring korbanos. It's not like, you know, there was the Jews themselves had turned it. It was turned and turned back, and there were times when they weren't doing the avodah, but there were times when they were. And when it broke, you better believe that there was a great moment of sadness. There was a great loss that was experienced then. And when they had it, you know, but before that happened, so you know, there is a notion of the world keeping going. And therefore, in a sense, we do have to see this as something of an extra. Not an extra like power windows, you know, like some, you know, nice thing, but in a certain sense, as that the world can function without it. The world does function without it. There comes still a point sort of a decision. It doesn't just crumple by itself. The world does function without it. So that's the practical way to explain it. But I want to tell you what I really think, which is like this. Unfortunately, the world functions without it. Unfortunately, the world functions without it, but it wasn't always that way. When wasn't it that way? Before the Mabul, it wasn't that way. What did Hashem say after the Mabul? He said to Noach the most reassuring words and the most disappointing words. He said to Noach, Noach, I'm never going to destroy the world anymore. Noach, from here on in, the world will turn the way it always did, the way it always should. Day and night, seasons, winter, fall, summer, spring, all going to just keep going and marching on. The world will be very, very predictable, very, very, you can anticipate, just Olam Kiminhagei Night. There will be no more trauma. So you say, okay, that's very comforting words. I feel better. I don't have to worry about that fellow in the park standing on the soapbox with the what do they call it? You know, with those boards that he wears, right? Huh? Sandwich boards, right? Saying, you know, the world is coming to an end, right? I'm okay. I don't have to worry about that fellow in Western Maryland who has Noah's Ark being built on the side of the highway. You know, right? You've seen it. So you know, they're Meshugayim. The world isn't going to come to an end because Hashem promised that the world is going to keep on going. I could feel good. But you know something? It's also a very devastating word. Why? Because whereas before, the inner world wasn't so separated from the outer world. You would see, you know, things are going well, then things are going well. If things aren't going well on the inside, when people are corrupt, it has a reflection. Why do we live in a world where bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? It's because of this schism that exists between, you know, religion and morality and goodness and reality. You know, get real. Right? If you're not going to go and pull a few fast ones, you know, you're not going to have enough money to bring home. I don't understand. Isn't the world supposed to turn on morality? Sure is, right? But that is so hidden, right? We know, as people of faith, that we're not going to advance one inch, right, if we do something wrong in order to have that advance. Ultimately, we won't advance one inch. But, you know, in the short term, down here, we might. We might. So, that was a product of the Mabul. HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to Noach and he said, you know, the world before was a pretty exciting place. Adam HaRishon eats the wrong apple, right? The bad apple, and what happens? The whole world turns upside down. We go from, you know, instant baby to difficulties with childbirth. We go with accessible, easy parnasa to you gotta sweat, you gotta toil. We go from immortality to mortality. Right? A change in the relationship to God changes the entire world. Cain kills Hevel, and once upon a time he walked down the street and no animal would approach him. Now they're yipping at his heels. Right? They're ready to tear him apart to pieces. He needs special protection. He can find no rest in any place. The whole world responds to it. And in a certain sense, as we find even scriptures before not. Right, the people start doing things wrong, and right, the land starts producing wrong plants, right? The land acts, so to speak, immorally. All of that, if it wasn't destroyed, it was peeled back dramatically. And it's a reflection of what we have talked about before, which is like with Adam HaRishon, where you saw his soul written all over every part of his body. You saw he was a different person because there was a soul in him. So what, he doesn't look like a monkey, right? You know, the soul transformed him completely. But now, you know, you have an neshama. But somebody will go and look and they'll make that nice chart, right? And write the thing and they'll say, you know, here, monkey person, you know, smart monkey, right? So, you know, monkey stand up straight, right? And so on and so forth. Right? Why? Because the physical world has become divorced from its spiritual essence. And it'll just keep going despite it. When it's supposed to die, it'll die, despite the fact that the soul lives on. The soul says, come on, come on, come on, keep going. Sorry, I'm independent. I do my own thing. And that is not necessarily a positive thing. It may, in a certain sense, bring us that badly needed stability that we so desire, but on the other hand, it's a sign of this terrible separation. So what happens? All of these things become an extra. Except in one place. And the Beis HaMikdash is not an extra. Because the Beis HaMikdash is the one place that's supposed to remain on this earth where the presence of Hashem is not extra equipment, it's essential equipment. And to a lesser degree, but also to a certain degree, Eretz Yisrael. When Chazal say that Eretz Yisrael did not have the waters of the Mabul fall on it, what they're saying as well, as our Chazal understood, was that all of the transformative effects of the Mabul did not take place in Eretz Yisrael. So you find, as we had in the Ramban in last week's Parsha, that why did Sodom go under? I don't understand. Weren't there other corrupt places in the world? So the Ramban, Sodom went under because Eretz Yisrael vomited up Sodom. Eretz Yisrael is like the Mabul. Eretz Yisrael is like, the Ramban doesn't say it in his words, but it's like the pre-diluvian world, right? It's before the Mabul. It can't take it. You have a place like Sodom, it rips it out, it turns it over in the ground. And we have described in the Torah, right, very good. And the Torah describes it, right? If you're going to go to Eretz Yisrael and you're going to be immoral, the land will spit you out like it spit out the nations which came before you. And when Sanherib came and conquered the king of Assyria, and he conquered the region, and he took Jews and he moved them out, right, the 10 tribes, and he told them to get lost, and then he brought in others into Eretz Yisrael to replace them, what happened? Right, other nations came in. What do they know? And what happened? Lions started attacking them. So what's going on over here? So you don't understand. You're in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael's not going to put up with what you're doing here. And so they converted. And some say that they were genuine converts. And some say they were Geirei Aroyos. They converted. They were lions converts. That's what they're called. In other words, they were just, you know, it was very, very superficial. They just, you know, needed to do what they do to go on. you know, there's something called where we see the spiritual as being inherent or we see it as being an extra. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, when at the end of Masechta Saita, that when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so you know, the fruits before had been so fatty. That's the expression which the Gemara uses. It doesn't sound well in English, but it was so, they were so juicy, so lush. When the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, they weren't so juicy anymore. And things like that. As well, you see, you know, it's an extra. Right? You could still eat a grape. But once upon a time, you'd eat a grape, right? And you go, wow, a grape. And now you go, a grape. It's an extra. Isn't that terrible? Wouldn't it be great if, you know, we were living in lightning bolt city, you know, where something, you know, you went wrong and immediately you'd see the reaction, but we're divorced from the spiritual reality. And even the little bits, you know, tsaras, leprosy. What's leprosy? Oh, you know what leprosy is. It's dermatitis, right? No. Leprosy in Hopkins Hospital or in Sinai is dermatitis or whatever it is. But what leprosy is in the Torah is that the presence of Hashem was in this person. That's why he was alive and well. But when you see that the person is failing, so that starts to disappear. And it expresses itself physically. That's why you can have it in a house. That a house will discolor. That a garment will discolor. Houses don't get dermatitis or brickitis or whatever you would call it. Right? However, if you understand that their way they look is not just a result of physicality, but it's because of the presence of Hashem that's within it, and that presence fades, it's going to look different. It's going to look different. It says the Rambam, the rationalist, and says the Ramban, you know, but when we really lost the presence of Hashem to such a great degree because of the Golus, it's going to look the same before and after. We don't have Tzaras anymore. We don't have Tzaras anymore because the physical became divorced from the spiritual. And you know what it is? It's now the inner room. Right? If somebody comes to the house, they'll say, oh, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous. They sit in the living room, they see you've already laid down the carpet over the paint, they haven't seen the Shrek that is the room back there that they have the contractor hasn't even dreamed about yet. Right? They haven't seen it yet, but they think everything is fine, all's well. And that's the way it is. That's where Ruchnius is today. All's well. It's b'bote gavoy. Hashem's crying in the inner room, the room that nothing has happened. That's what we're describing. Non-essential? Unfortunately, yeah. Because the spiritual world is divorced from the physical, now that piece is no longer essential. Good morning. Nice to meet you. Okay, I wanted to just end with Rav Lutner. Rav Lutner has a maimer on this Gemara, which to me is a gripping maimer. Rav Lutner says like this. He's focused specifically on the Gemara's expression. What is he crying on? Gemara says, Mipnei Geva. What's Geva? Geva is Gava, greatness. The greatness of the Jewish people that was taken from them and given to the nations of the world. So Rav Lutner is intrigued by this terminology, taken from them and given to the nations of the world. What does that mean? Rav Lutner says, I'm sure that it's a beautiful thing. But why is he crying? They're crying in a hidden place. So he says like this. Kol Yisrael had greatness. And think back to the first Beis HaMikdash, Shlomo HaMelech's time. We had a Beis HaMikdash. And with it, we had a general strength in the whole world around us. Everybody came, they recognized the wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech. And he was the great one, and he was the one that everybody was, you know, trying to edge up to politically, and there was this great strength of the Jewish people, and this great visible and wonderful, you know, thing there that we had going. And you know what else we had? We had the presence of Hashem within us. We had prophets. We had divine inspiration in a measure that just doesn't exist nowadays. There's the Urim, the Tumim. We had all kinds of things. Now, fast forward, the year 2006. Or, you know, to be even, well, let's fast forward to year 2006. So what do we have? We have a Beis HaMikdash? Nope. Right? Who's on the Har HaBayis? Right? We have the Muslims are sitting there on the Har HaBayis on the Temple Mount. Right? So now at least we have the Eretz Yisrael, some of it, but we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. Right? Do we have this great thing, all the nations of the world are coming to be diplomatic, you know, with us? No. Right? They're coming to condemn us. Right? Instead of, right? So we have, Baruch Hashem, we have one friend. Right? But that's it. Okay, so who has that stuff? Right? So somebody else has the power, right? The United States, let's say, is the one that everybody's going to. Now maybe nobody has it. Sometimes it's shared, sometimes it's Sancheriv, sometimes it's Nebuchadnezzar, sometimes it's the Romans, whatever it is. But it's, somebody's got it. Or it's shared, we don't got it. The Beis HaMikdash, Har HaBayis, somebody's got it, we don't got it. Prophecy? We lost it, and nobody has it. So there is Gav, right, and other examples like that. Right? Thing, the Orion, the Ark. What happened with that? It was Nignas. It was hidden away, it was buried away. Right? Leshotu bo yodai. Nobody else was able to get it. So there are aspects of the greatness of Gavos and Shal Yisrael that were taken from us and given to the nations of the world. And there are aspects of Gavos and Shal Yisrael that were taken from us but not given to the nations of the world. So I ask you, my friends, where are those? They're in storage. Where? Not at that place down Reisterstown Road. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a place called Nistarim. A place called Mistarin, where those treasures of the world that were taken away and not returned to the world yet, where he holds on, so to speak, to those special treasures, waiting with him, in a certain sense, waiting to give them back. So now picture yourself. Somebody who, Achves, you know, he was a Jew in Germany. Right? In 1930, he had an estate on the countryside, a beautiful, beautiful mansion. He had factories, he had businesses. Comes 1933, Hitler Yimach Shemo rises to power. He starts to get nervous. Comes 1939, Nuremberg laws, Kristallnacht. Right? This factory is taken away from him. Right? He's got to leave, he's got to run. He's running from the Nazis, right? And what does he do? He takes a quick look around his house. He picks up, you know, a face, you know, the mezuzah off the doorpost. He picks up a couple of heirloom, you know, pieces of silver that he had in his thing. Whatever it is, his sitter, you know, his Rudelheim sitter, his whatever it is, and he puts it in this little satchel, this little suitcase he's going to be able to take. And he goes and he runs off. Wherever it is that he runs off to. And now he's on a boat. He's on a boat to America. He's on a boat to Palestine. So what does he do? He goes down into his room in the hold, and he opens up the suitcase. And he looks at the mezuzah. This is what he saved. And what is he thinking while he looks at the mezuzah? He says, oh my gosh. Remember the doorpost. Remember the building. Remember everything that I had to leave behind. This is what I salvaged. And look what's lost. Kadosh Baruch Hu goes to a place called Mistar, where he has those things that were taken from the world and would not be, nobody would ever be able to touch them until Kadosh Baruch Hu was ready to give it back. And he's cherishing them. And he's crying over those things that the other people got their hands on. Things that he could not, you know, take with him, so to speak. Things which would be left there. The Beis HaMikdash, Magma, things would be left there. Couldn't, right? The nations of the world, if it's not in the hands of the Jews. Nidlo mehen, v'nidlo v'nisala. Isn't that unbelievable? Isn't that gorgeous? Oh my gosh. And it's a reality. It's a...